time when wargamers played with chainmail, and the rise of the Wizards of the Coast, there was an age of gamers. And unto this, Gygax, destined to bear the crown jewel of TSR upon a troubled brow, to show you all how to roll for initiative.
Issue number 65 of the Roll for Initiative podcast. I'm one of your hosts, DM Vince, sitting along with DM Nick.
Heyo!
And DM Will. Will, how are you this week?
Hey there, I'm doing good.
You're back again, and you'll be with us for quite some time, it seems.
That's awesome.
He has to stay. We got him locked in the dungeon with the kobolds.
Right. We have him handcuffed to Jason's old chair. We should probably throw that chair out and get a new one, right? Yeah, probably.
Nah, we're on a budget.
Yeah.
And that's Matt.
And as always, producer Matt sitting in the background.
Hello, everyone.
How's it going, Matt?
Oh, going well.
Good. All right, so what's been going on? Nick, let's just jump into the stars this week, because we've been doing a long show lately, so.
Yeah, I came down with the goblin pox a couple of weeks ago, and now I'm filing over it.
Aw. So.
Actually, it was strep I got. Somehow the kids got it, and I got it, but anyway. So let's head on over to iTunes and see what we have for our stars for this week. And we have two new reviews. One we have from DM Green Dragon.
Oh.
And we get 5 stars for DM Green Dragon.
Woo.
He says, "This podcast is the reason podcasts were invented."
Okay.
Wow. So there I was, sick to death of the third edition, which not be named, looking at my old AD&D books. Sure that in a world this big, somewhere out there must be playing it on a hunch. I searched in iTunes and I found a podcast whose greatness is rivaled only by Orson Welles' The Shadow.
Wow. Oh, no.
Hey. Okay. An entire world was opened up to me by DM Vincent, Nick, and Jason. The feeling was almost like when I first read my brother's Moldvay Basic Rules. I have been listening with my wife, and she loves it too. The podcast has gotten my wife interested in the game, and it has helped me get back up to speed for running a game. Before mentioned, DMs keep it entertaining and informative, especially with the help of guests such as Julie Hoverson. And I love the bumper for Creature Feature Theater. It sounds like that cool 80s horror movie music. So thank you, DM Green Dragon. Orson Welles' The Shadow? Really?
Wow.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
At least he didn't say War of the Worlds.
Oh, yeah.
Well, okay. You know what, DM Green Dragon, just to let you know, there, besides Roll for Initiative, if you're interested in the original D&D, there's also Save or Die. And if you're interested in that second edition game, there's Thacko's Hammer as well.
Yeah.
So you got a whole range there to listen to.
Whole family.
So much
podcast
to listen to, your head will explode.
Like scanners.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you, DM Green Dragon. And our next one is from Sandra Gray 6. She gives us 5 stars as well.
All right.
She says, "Wonderful, informative show." And said, "These guys make a great show. The hosts all know their stuff, yet they have different styles, so their listeners get exposed to a number of different ways to run the game. The show has interesting features, including Creature Feature Theater, Dragon's Horde, Table Manners, the library, etc. Despite their emphasis on first edition AD&D, the show is useful and entertaining for anyone running a fantasy RPG campaign from any system. Highly recommended. It's swell and peachy keen." Thank you, Sandra Gray.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Well, you know, we try to have everybody on, I think, on the show that hosts it. We try to have different viewpoints on being a DM and also being a player, because we both, I think all of us have been on both sides of the DM screen.
Mm.
So I think, and we have a lot of experience, a lot of years of experience coming here. We're all grognards here in one way or another, blah, blah, blah. Yes. Get those damn kobolds off my lawn. And it is first edition AD&D, so, you know, but I'm glad that if you feel you can port stuff over, you know, I hope it's useful. So,
wow.
Folks, yeah. Just keep the reviews coming, like we said in the past. We read all of our reviews, good or bad. Just head on over to iTunes, type in Roll for Initiative over there in the iTunes store, and you will have yourselves heard. So thank you very much, everyone. And it looks like we are up to 83 reviews right now.
Woo!
Very close to 100.
That's awesome.
Very close, Nick. Very close.
Yes.
Very close.
96 is very close, Nick.
Well, I think it's all relative.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'm just saying.
So let's head down the lines of what everyone's been doing this week. Matt, what have you been doing this week?
Oh, this week my gaming groups were starting a Deadlands campaign. Using the original system Pinnacle release back in 99, not the new Savage Worlds variant. Uh-huh. So we just sat around, created our characters, and we're actually going to start our campaign next week. So looking forward to that.
So you're using the original deck of cards?
Yes, deck of cards, the poker chips, all of that. Yes. So.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
What about you, Will?
Well, ran my normal four groups. The biggest change is that we have dropped 3.5 entirely. Everyone converted over the Pathfinder. And the Call of Cthulhu group is still doing its normal thing, dying and living as they go. And they made their foray into Ravenloft this weekend, and we spent about 6 hours just exploring the city and about a good 10-mile radius outside of the city. They probably won't go into the castle till next weekend.
Oh. Wait a minute. You mean you're not playing a first edition game?
Oh, no. Yeah, I am playing a first edition game now.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Oh, yeah? Is that the Ravenloft one? Or...
Well, what I did was I converted the I6 Ravenloft into the Pathfinder module and everything, but there's a group of four people that, you know, we tinker with first edition from time to time, but we played that 2 weeks ago. We won't start till next week on that.
Oh, okay, cool.
Oh, okay. You're excused. Nick?
Yeah. Oh, yes?
What have you been doing, Mr. Stars?
Besides recovering from that strep throat thing,
I've
been sending emails back and forth in my gaming group of where you're going to play next and everything. And I said, finally, hey, why do we have to play this? I mean, let's play. I got a couple options here. What do you guys think? One was first edition AD&D. The other was Call of Cthulhu. And everybody was like, hey, first edition AD&D, let's do it. So we're going to next Saturday... we're going to start a first edition AD&D campaign. It's going to be World of Greyhawk with some added modifications of my own. And we're going to do that. It's going to be very, very cool. I'm looking forward to it. In fact, I might have the kids come and play. my two daughters, yeah.
Nice.
So... Because one of the couples they have a daughter, Eileen, and she played in our Hackmaster game for a while, and she's like, I think she's 10, and my girls are like 11 and 12 respectively. I asked them if they wanted to play. They're like, yeah, sure. And I say, well, as long as you don't mind us all, you know, it'll be like to the wee hours in the morning, and they're like, sure, okay. And so we might have my two girls come with me on our next game night. It'll be very cool. So
yay.
Nice.
Yeah, and then another generation of gamer geeks is born.
Good job.
What
Nick.
About you, Vince? What's up?
Well, other than playing the Book of Sorrows campaign, which I didn't play last Thursday because anniversary came up, so we went out of town.
Oh.
So we did not play. But we had that going for us, and what else was going on? Oh, I've been reading, was it Edgar Rice Burroughs' novel, Princess of Mars? I've been reading that recently.
Good book.
Yeah, for some reason I got into that kick and I grabbed that book and picked it up and started reading it. So,
well, you know about that Disney film coming out, right?
Yes, I heard about that.
Yeah, I saw a couple of previews for it. And I think there's also, as always, there's previews on YouTube. But from what I understand, they are sticking very, very close to the source material.
Well, they better.
I mean, you know, how the character is a Civil War veteran and all that, tries to head out west.
Yes.
From what I understand, they're pretty much sticking to that storyline. They're not modernizing it or anything like that. I think that's part of the mystique of it all.
I can't wait to see if they're sticking to the storyline. I can't wait to see how they handle the whole creature in the cave.
Oh, yeah. That ought to be kind of cool. I don't know. We'll see.
Master! They're at the gates again! Master! It looks like another band of adventurers!
Adventurers? Again? Always the same. Coming to me for sage advice.
Sage advice this week. We do have a voicemail and a bunch of emails. Looks like we got a big influx of new listeners, as I noticed our numbers went up a little bit higher last month. Matt, did you notice that as well?
Yeah, I noticed that we had just overall an average level that was higher than normal. So, hello, yeah. All you new listeners. Thank you for coming. Hope you stay.
Yes, they'll stay because they love us. But we do have a voicemail message here from one of our listeners, and I'll play that. So just mute your microphones real quick, guys.
All right. Hey, guys. This is DM Kojo. Just wanted to call and talk NPCs with you a little bit. Specifically, I'm very interested in the variety of NPCs that popped up in Dragon magazines over the years. Some that really caught my eye and I've used in the past, would like to use in the future. The Archer in Dragon 45, the Bounty Hunter in 52, the Anti-Paladin in 39, the Incantatrix in 90, the Time Lord in Dragon 65, the Alchemist in Dragon 130, and the Beastmaster in Dragon 119. Like I said, I've used these before as NPCs. I wondered if you guys had used them before, or what your take was on any of these NPC classes. But also, I was wondering if you would ever allow some of these interesting NPCs to be used as player characters in any of your campaigns, or do you think it would unbalance things too much? That would be an interesting twist. I'd like to hear your take on it. Keep up the good work. DM Kojo out.
All right. So, anyone want to start that one off? Nick, since you're talking, go ahead.
I remembered a few of those. There were some other ones I recall. There was the Duelist. I remember that one.
Yeah.
And I think one by Len Lakofka and Limud's Tiny Hut. He did one called the Death Master. Remember that one? He's kind of like a necromancer in a way.
Right.
Yeah, I remember the article on the Anti-Paladin. There's also the Berserker, the Scribe. There's a whole bunch of them.
Use them? Or
I
no?
I can't recall using them as NPCs, but I remember when a lot of these came about. There was several people who thought, well, why can't we use them as player characters? You know, I never understood the rationale behind why some of these NPC classes are only NPC classes, like the Archer, for example. I mean, I can't understand why couldn't that be a player character class.
It could be.
One, obviously, why I don't think it could be a player character class is the Anti-Paladin.
Yeah. Well, if you can be an assassin, why not be an Anti-Paladin?
Well, true. But I remember, with the Anti-Paladin, though, I know you get higher levels. Some of your hirelings or henchmen are like orcs and goblins and what have you. Yeah. You can control undead. So I don't know if that's for your particular flavor of campaign. If you were going to do an all-evil campaign, I guess. Sure, why not? I mean, who says you can't? I mean, I never understood the rationale why some of these classes can't be player characters. I do remember, though, when the ninja came out, NPC class.
Right, right.
And there was this one guy. It was like every character that he played, it was like multi-classed with ninja. I don't know why. I don't know where he thought it was okay, because some of us were like, you can't play that. It's a ninja. That's an NPC. But he was like, he would play magic user slash ninja. Fighter slash ninja.
Bard slash ninja. So he sings as he sneaks through the shadows.
Hey, how about a ninja slash ninja?
Wow.
Yeah.
Double ninja.
Ninja slash pirate.
That'd be kind of cool.
But I don't know why he always wanted to play a ninja. Maybe he just thought, you know, he could... His characters could walk in between the raindrops.
Was it the shadow part ninja, part pirate or something?
I don't know.
I have to go check that out.
I don't know. I mean, what do you think, Will, on some of these NPC classes?
Well, I mean, I have used them as NPCs, and I did, you know, modify some of them to be more or less a PC class. The bandit is a prime example, and the alchemist is another. I was just talking to Vince about that earlier today. And I do have a problem with the anti-paladin. I was not a fan of the anti-paladin. Just because you have a force for good doesn't mean there's always an opposite but equal force for evil. So the anti-paladin is a non-existent NPC in my campaign overall. I'm not a big fan of the anti-paladin whatsoever. But no, you know, one class I was surprised that he did not mention was the Owry. I don't know if you're all familiar with that character class or not.
Doesn't sound familiar to me. Which one issue was that in?
I'll have to remember the Dragon magazine, but the Owry was more or less like a very... You know who would know that? Professor Thork. Because this is the type of character that he would play. This is a very very similar to a seductress type of class. A spellcaster. She, you know, had a high charisma and a very high comeliness. And she cast spells like a magic user, and it all revolved around, you know, beauty, charisma, and comeliness, and so on like that. I've seen that played, you know, once or twice, you know, in the last 30-something years or so.
Oh, I've never heard of that one.
It sounds familiar now that he's describing it.
Oh, yes, it's kind of funny and everything, because there's one spell that she actually cast on someone that will make that person just completely repulsive, and, you know, kids will throw rocks at you. a pig would avoid, you know, crossing the street when you are, you know, that kind of stuff like that. So it's a very interesting character and everything, but I, if I'm correct, I believe that was a player class, though, so it wasn't really an NPC, but would make definitely for an NPC. No, I'm a big fan of NPCs being player characters. A berserker, that's awesome. A bandit? Why not? Yeah. That's good. Yeah. An alchemist? Certainly. Why not?
I don't know. An alchemist wouldn't do so well in adventuring, maybe.
I couldn't see playing a scribe. That would be kind of boring, I think. It's like a lighter version of the cleric, the scribe.
I remember the Beast Lord. I remember actually playing the Beast Lord once. Joe actually let us try as an experiment. He didn't like it, though.
The legendary Joe DM?
Yes. And he, after much annoyance by me, he let me play the anti-paladin, and he showed me why the anti-paladin is not really a good class to play.
That would make sense.
Hunting you down and trying to kill you?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, when I hear that, you know, that Beast Lord or the Beastmaster class, the only thing I think of is the movie, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Matt?
Podo and Podo.
Yeah, I mean, really... I think any of the classes could be used as PC. I mean, just it really depends on the type of game and type of the feel of the game you're wanting to go. Mm-hmm. Even the scribe, I think you could work into a game if you were wanting to play, say, a bureaucratic middle management medieval fantasy game.
Oh, perhaps papers and paychecks.
Yes, exactly. So parchment and copper pieces in this case.
There you go.
So, but... I mean, really, depending on the type of game, anything could work, and it's just a matter of being creative enough to make it work in a way that's actually fun for everyone to play, as opposed to, well, I have this type of game, but we're going to have this NPC character, now a player class, that just doesn't fit with the feel or flow of the game at all, and at that. So it just really depends on what's your campaign, what makes sense for it. It's right. Like how in Will's, he doesn't use the anti-paladin because it just doesn't exist in his world. Yeah, because right. The world he created, it just doesn't exist. And I think those are the type of choices that need to be made, not on a mechanical rules level, but on a creative theme of the game. Does it break the theme of the game? Will it break the story being told just by having it exist? Not so much. I don't think mechanically there's any reason you couldn't use them, but I think more for thematic reasons you may want to exclude some.
Yeah, didn't Gary always say Dragon Magazine was supposed to be a source of optional ideas for all DMs and players?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, Dragon Magazine and White Dwarf Magazine are non-canon. Plain and simple.
Yeah. Agreed. Well, thanks for the voicemail. Anyone else that wants to chime in and give us a call, 570-865-4210, the hotline.
Hotline.
Where Nick is standing by.
No.
Oh, sorry.
We have goblins standing by.
Now they're goblins? The kobolds walked out?
Well, yeah, we got to rotate staff.
Oh, I see. All right, so let's go on to our emails.
Okay.
First email comes from Super Nintendo Chalmers. I love that name. I've heard that name so many times before here. So. He basically says he's been listening to the show for a better part of a year now, and he's having trouble finding a group. He's tried gaming over Skype in the chat rooms, but it's not the same. All his gamers in his areas are 3, 3, 5, and the edition that shall not be named. He says, I refuse to settle for playing those games. My only question to you guys are, why haven't you done an episode on Thieves? You've briefly spoke about Thieves Cant, and that's about it. I started playing a Thief class shortly after I started playing AD&D and haven't looked back since. I've tried the other classes, but nothing compares to Thief for me. I'm interested in hearing your take on quite possibly the most fun class of all time. Take care and happy gaming, Super Nintendo Chalmers. I don't think we've done anything on a Thief, though. Not looking at the notes. Matt, did you find anything?
No. Going through it, we have not covered Thief.
Well, I'll be doggone. I guess we're going to have to do it.
Yeah. Doggone it. Let's do it then.
Not today, though.
No. Not today. Maybe not tomorrow. But sometime in the future. How about that?
Maybe. If you're good. Possibly. If you're good, Nick.
If I'm good?
Yes.
I'm always good.
Oh, okay.
Chaotic good, preferably.
Yes. We have another email coming in from Andrew. He has a comment and two questions. The worst part about Assassins is that they put a price on the living civilized creatures. How much is it worth you to have your neighbor killed? Sorry. That's a nasty question to even contemplate. I just did. Whoops. I hope PC Assassin is more of a big bad hunter. Question number one. What makes Paladins the most controversial? I would have thought Cavaliers got top billing, followed by Monks, then possibly Assassins. Paladins are fighters with very limited healing spells, a nice horse, the ability to detect evil, and a code of conduct that must suck to follow. They are far from unbalanced, and they are an archetype from European lore. Is there a problem with how they were introduced? Well, that's the question number one. I'll go to question number two when we answer this one.
I don't have a problem with the Paladin.
I think most of the problem with Paladins come from not the character or the background lore, but how people play them.
Yep.
And that they play them as the ultimate...
Stupid.
Yes, lawful stupid. The ultimate, oh no, that was not exactly to the T of the law. I must cut your head off now because you're an evil lawbreaker. Yeah, they end up becoming, instead of lawful good, lawful stupid, and... If you have that type of player in your group playing a paladin, it can make for a lot of inter-party conflict, to say the least. And I think that's where a lot of the controversy comes from.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is players handling the class not well, like Matt said.
Yeah.
It's just they play them as lawful stupid, and they're not. Every class has its advantages and disadvantages. You got to learn how to play with it and fill out that role. If But I think some people had some misconceptions about the class and how they are. They're not like that at all. They're not ignorant of the world and the way how way things work.
No, of course you could play it that way, but that'd be like a stupid stereotype.
Right. This is what my issue is with the Paladin, basically. You know, the problem is how a DM and the players adjudicate, detect evil. Right. I think that's the biggest problem. Another thing that must be clarified also is how is the campaign world designed as far as civilized societies and their boundaries? What is, you know, lawful in one land may not be lawful in another land. Therefore, when people play these paladins and think that they go into another country where the laws are the opposite of the one where they come from, they think it's their automatic right to go around saying, well, this is wrong. They're going to impose their will and their laws from their country when they're in fact in another foreign country where it's irrelevant and it's criminal to do so.
Right.
Players have a problem with this detect evil thing, and that's, I think, what causes the biggest problem. But the next problem is the writing, that paladins will only be in groups with certain aligned characters. So therefore, that imposes upon the players that you have to play a character of a specific alignment or what have you. And a lot of players don't like that, being told, well, I have to play a good character because he's playing a paladin. I think that's where the conflict comes in.
I thought part of it was knowingly work in a group of evil characters. What if he does? If he doesn't know.
If he doesn't know, I mean, a paladin can't just detect evil. They have to have some sort of reason to detect evil.
Right. Not necessarily. There's nothing that states he can use detect evil anytime he wants to. I mean, yeah, if he sees something that sounds suspicious, but nothing stops a paladin just from using his power and say, I'm just going to detect evil now. And you're right, though. I mean, it's just the way how people play them and how people perceive them and what is set in motion from the very beginning when a person plays a paladin.
Yeah, I don't allow them to do detect evil every 5 seconds. It's just, I hate that. People, right. detect evil. It's like, oh, you burnt out on detect evil for now.
And to be honest with you, and even if the player doesn't knowingly know that the character another person is playing is evil, that means the other person's probably not playing the character properly if they are. You see where I'm coming from? There's something wrong somewhere.
Well, you can always hide your evil.
Right, or if they're... You play a evil character, but he's being very manipulative.
Yeah.
They can be playing the character right. They're actually manipulating the paladin to help them accomplish. So it can be done. It's just, it requires a certain type of group to make it work right. If you have the evil thief who wants to pickpocket everyone he sees in the group with the paladin, it's not going to work. But if you have that thief that's a little more grand, thinks bigger than stealing the 5 copper piece belt pouch, then you can have them work together without the paladin actually knowing it.
Right.
I can see that too as well. But I think that another factor is also above board knowledge and metagaming. And that's where it becomes a critical factor there.
Yeah. Actually, why don't we table this and save it for the paladin specials?
Okay.
That sounds good to me.
This is going to break into a whole bunch of arguments here, I can see already. So. We already got 2 different sides here, so maybe 3, because Nick is quiet, so.
Yeah, I'm good. Chaotic, not lawful good, though.
Oh, sorry. Second question, back to Andrew's email. Getting back to the skills that shall not be referenced, what are these acronyms now?
We'll have to have a cliff notes for just all of our acronyms at this point.
Yeah, really. He's talking about the 3d6 method of rolling under a strength for breaking open, say, a chest or bashing it open. Uh-huh. He saw this succeed most of the time, so he switched to 4d6 and then finally 5d6. And so he sees the chance of failure equal to the idea of how hard it is to break open a strong box. How do you guys get started estimating the chances for various actions? What basis do you use for deciding that it's 3d6 for a good skill check or higher? Or such and such. I'm just generally curious how you guys handle that. I use this method a lot, and depending on how hard it is, just estimating, I start with 3d6 and then move upwards. If I think it's a little bit harder than normal, I go to 4d6 and yada, 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 or whatever.
What about you guys? What about you, William?
Well, I mean, it's to break open a lockbox or, I mean, you know, really be honest with you, I never used that system of method of breaking open a lockbox or any of that kind of skill, to be honest with you, in all my time playing.
You've never used the 3D6 roll under the stat to see if you succeed?
No, sir. Actually, what I did do was I actually used a 20-sider to determine that. You know, and, you know, I gave it a set factor. Well, you know, if he wants to break off, the situation dictates. Like I said, I have never, ever used it. I mean, you know, the most, I think they'll use those kind of things. It's like, you know, like bin bars, lift gates, that kind of the percentage. And then there is a jam door, for example. How do you open a jam door? It's like a 1 of 4 or 1 of 3, depending on your strength. It all depends.
Okay.
Yeah. This is where my group, we've used a D30.
30, jeez.
A D30.
I have one of those.
Yes, they're useful. We've mostly used it in the Palladium system where you will get attributes like 21, 22. But depending on the difficulty, maybe that D20, then the percent of success isn't enough. If you're going, it's too easy using a D20. That's when you can pull out that D30. Or maybe you want to say, okay, it's a percentile.
Yeah.
It all depends on, you have to determine, how hard do I want this to be?
I think also what William was talking about, like using a D20 roll, is for other ability scores that might be used besides strength. For example, maybe using your intelligence score to figure out, I don't know, figure out where, maybe a riddle or something like that. Maybe to give you a hint about something. I don't know.
Yes, exactly. That's how I use that method. And I only say this because we went into this one module. I'm just going to say this real quick, like, and everything. The Lost Caverns of Socanth. Are y'all familiar with that module?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, at the very end where inside the casket or the coffin of the vampire?
Yes.
All those tomes in there and everything? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it had been simpler if we just took the time to open it instead of the doggone barbarian, or I'm sorry, the fighter, bashing it open or slicing it open with a battle axe.
Uh-oh.
You know what? You know, all the tomes were destroyed. Thank you, you know?
Yeah.
But again, you know, stuff like that happens sometimes.
Cool. Well, you do what you do, and that's how you do it. There.
Yeah. As long as you're consistent, I think that's if you use a 3D6 or a D20 or in Matt's case, a D30, which is like a giant boulder. As long as you're consistent as a DM when determining these ability checks,
yes,
I think is the most important thing.
Consistency is the most important thing. You're correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the email. Next email comes from Butterbur. And he says, hey guys, just wanted to shout out quickly and tell you I love the podcast, and I'm very happy with your relaunch. I've been listening for a few months now, and although I do miss Jason, I am very happy with the addition of Will. See, Will, people like you. Yeah. He has an awesome voice for radio. Look at that, Will.
That's awesome.
And he seems to know his stuff, which is fantastic for a newbie 1E player like myself that got started on 3E. Oh, sorry. Perhaps, and it's just a suggestion, he can get a new microphone, however, because his voice sounds a bit screechy. Well, that just depends on the microphone. It's mostly Skype, not his microphone.
Yeah, it's a Skype thing.
But we're working on it, don't worry. Anyways, just wanted to say that I love the show and love listening to it while jogging. That's the third most thing that people listen to our show. It's either at work, jogging, or sitting at their computer.
There's gamers that exercise?
Apparently, and that's awesome.
Apparently he does. I've heard a lot of people say they're jogging and they'll listen to our show, or walk through the park and listen to our show. Quick question. After 5 years of non-interest in my gaming hobbies, I've finally convinced my girlfriend to play a game of AD&D 1E with me. Any of you folks have tips for making her first session fun enough to hook her? Thanks, guys. Butterbur.
Well,
usually when I start people out who have never played a game like this, I usually start it out by doing a lot of role play, not letting them worry about dice and papers and pencils and things like that. Just let them role play. I'll do all the rolling. And then slowly I'll start integrating like dice into the game and let them show them what the difference it is between role playing and kind of doing a White Wolf type thing and then working your way into AD&D.
Right. That's a good way of doing it. Absolutely. Yeah, you just want to start rules light, because if you throw the player's handbook at her and say, yeah, you need to know all this and then we can play, it ain't going to work. But if you just say, okay, here's your character, just, what do you want to do? Just leave it at that and just work off of it. Start rules light. When you do combat, don't worry about all the various modifiers or weapon speeds if you use those. Just keep it as simple as possible. It may even be worth, I know you said you wanted to use 1E, maybe pull out basic.
Yeah. Head back to basics, even easier than 1E to start.
Right. I mean, that'd be a great way to introduce someone to role-playing, because it's rules light, but it gives you enough of a foundation that you can expand in easily into 1E. So
I even suggest, if you could find a copy of it, Holmes D&D. Because that leads right into Advanced 1E, so.
Yeah, that's perfect. And Vince and Matt, you hit the nail right in the head. That's exactly. Do it. Start with the role-playing. Rules light. Do it very slowly and just, you know, increase the pressure.
Yeah, as they get more into the game, start, you know, saying, well, okay, how about you roll this time? Things like that. Thank you. Next one comes from Ben. RFI Podcast. Thank you for the amazing podcast. Your family of podcasts are probably some of the best RPG podcasts out there. I give you 10 out of 5 stars. Wow.
Wow.
My question is about thieves. Another Martian. Can thieves wear other armors besides leather? If they can, do you give them a minus to their skill rolls if wearing heavier armor? Thank you. With respect to Gygax, TSR, and the crew, and none of the Wizards of the Coast.
Wow.
So, thieves can wear any armor they want. It's just they get penalties for wearing heavier armor. I think the penalties come in after leather, like studded leather. They start getting some minuses of 10% here and
there. They can wear leather and studded leather.
I think studded leather gives them some minuses, doesn't it?
I think so on certain abilities.
Like climbing and stuff.
They might lose some. Some thieves' abilities might. There might be a negative aspect. But I think officially, if we want to just go by the player's handbook, I think it's either leather or studded leather armor. In fact, I can look it up here real quick. Thief. It says leather, but I think that was revised in Unearthed Arcana. In fact, that might have been revised up to studded leather. So I could look that up here real quick, because I have my Unearthed Arcana up, because we're going to be talking about stuff in Unearthed Arcana in a little bit.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, I have it here too as well. Yep, I see it right here.
Leather, studded leather, padded, or elven chain.
Yeah, I think they came up with those additional ones in Unearthed Arcana, the padded and things like that.
But just remember, take a note at number 4 down there. A thief attired in anything other than leather armor must take adjustments to his or her chances of success in performing certain thieving functions.
Yep.
Yeah, so I was
there's
right.
A table in here if you go by Unearthed Arcana, yes, there's other armors that a thief can wear, but there are certain negative aspects to it. I think besides something that's leather, studded leather, padded, or elfin chain, if you want to have a thief wear plate mail, yeah, there's going to be some serious negative aspects to it.
Yeah, if you take a look at page 22, if you wear studded or padded, you're taking some serious minuses, especially to pickpockets, open locks, move silently, hide in shadows, and climb walls.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Cool.
You'd rather be a naked thief.
Yeah. Actually, it says none. You get bonuses, so
yeah,
that's why I know everybody I know, including myself, that's played a thief, always looking for braces of defense, cloaks of protection.
Yeah, just to wear all cloth, that stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
You get those bonuses.
Heck yeah!
Ben also wrote back another email because he forgot to add that he's also looking for a simple dungeon drawing software that is free and easy to use, so he can print his dungeons out when he is DMing. Not for miniatures, so he can reference when he's playing the game, pretty much. He said he tried Dungeon Crafter and was not impressed. Wasn't there, there was a software called Auto Realm? Wasn't Auto Realm one of them?
Yeah, Auto Realm.
That was a free one that was, you can make maps and dungeons with. There's also graph paper and pencil. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
No, there really aren't many free ones, and unfortunately, I have dungeon generators I can just use, so. I would look up dungeon generators. There's a lot of, there's a ton of them out there. You just click on it, and in fact, I think I know one offhand. Will, what do you have for that suggestions for this young man?
Unfortunately, I never, you know, went to free dungeon generators, what have you. I always used Campaign Cartographer, and I also used the dungeon mapping program that was in the Core Rules. Do you remember the DM, the CD, the Core Rules?
Yeah.
I used that program as well.
Yes, that was a Campaign Cartographer 2 that was
right.
In the Core Rules. Because, I have the Core Rules and the expansion. Because it also came with a fractal mapper for overland maps as well.
So I can't help you really on what's free out there, because I use the Campaign Cartographer 3 now, and I use Dungeony. And there's a couple other ones that I have bought over the years.
There was one, and I'm looking for the link right now because it just jogged my memory. It was at dizzydragon.net, and you were able to randomly put together a really cool-looking dungeon. Adventure Generator, I think it was called.
Yeah, you know what? There was another one. Yeah, there's another one online where you could use the old format for the black or blue maps, if you remember those.
Actually, Dizzy Dungeon Games.
Yes.
The Adventure Generator.
Yeah, dizzydragon.net and the Adventure Generator. Comes right up, and at the bottom there you can use the algorithm. He made up an algorithm from the Dungeon Master's Guide, so you can use those pieces in there to make your own dungeon.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Good.
And it comes
very
out really good, because you can use the old blue background or the wilderness background. Wow.
And then for the encounters in your dungeon, you actually have your choice of Mold Day Cook, Mold Day Basic, and D20 Pathfinder.
So there you go. It hasn't been updated in a while, but at least it's somewhere you could start.
Yeah.
Give you a good idea. So there you go, dizzydragon.net, Adventure Generator. Check it out. And that will conclude the emails, if you want to write us. How do you get in contact with us, Nick?
I forgot.
RFIstaff@gmail.com. Thank you.
That's right. I had to think about it. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay, Nick. You're not the oldest one on the podcast anymore, so. Let's head to table manners.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, a fella knew how to judge a fireball on the fly and how far the cleric could push the undead he turned. I tell ya, with all these min-maxers and munchkins, metagame and power game, there's something missing that I'm here to learn ya. Now sit down and crack your book while I commence to teach you some
table manners.
Table manners. On today's show, we're going to cover, like last week, another controversial character class from the Unearthed Arcana, the Barbarian.
Roar.
Well, I guess so. When I say get to the chopper, that's the Barbarian that I'm thinking about in all honesty.
Side, I played the original Barbarian.
Get to the chopper now!
Took my father's sword! Killed my people!
Okay. I shouldn't have said nothing. I knew this was going to happen today.
Hey, you. Yeah, too bad.
Well.
But basically, the Barbarian was based on a few famous creative works. And, you know, I got a little bit of this offline, and then, you know, I read some other things here. But the Barbarian is basically based on Robert E. Howard's Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
That's me.
Kothar from Gardner Fox's history, and to a lesser extent, Fritz Lieber's Fafred from the Great Mouser series and all that. Sure. I don't see how they make that analogy, but I can see somewhat to a certain extent. So basically, the Barbarian is a player class. He made his debut in a couple, you know, areas. To start off, White Dwarf Magazine number 4. And I will note that there are some significant differences between the Barbarian from that White Dwarf and that of the Unearthed Arcane. And I'll cover that here in a couple seconds.
So it actually showed up in White Dwarf, not Dragon first?
Yes.
That is correct. White Dwarf Magazine number 4. And you're going to love the differences between the White Dwarf variant and the official variant. And you know what? That's the key word right there. You said it right. The unofficial class is the White Dwarf. The official is the Unearthed Arcane Barbarian one.
Right.
Interesting.
Okay. So in, let's see here. In Dragon Magazine number 63, they cover the Barbarian again from Unearthed Arcana, just cover some rules issues and some complaints from Gary Gygax. You know, he covered that a lot.
Yeah.
And then we also have that the Barbarians mentioned in the Oriental Adventures hardback book as well.
Right. Yep.
Now, I do want to make a note that I also found out that the Barbarian was covered again in Dragon Magazine number 67. And this was a letter from Gary Gygax. So basically, Gary Gygax sent out a letter in Dragon Magazine to cover all the complaints concerning character classes, the Cavalier, the Thief Acrobat, and so on. Everything for any. Especially covered the Barbarian. And it's basically telling, you know, the complainers out there that the Barbarian is not an overpowered class, that it's more or less an underpowered class. And what I will do is that once this show is released on the website, I will ensure that I make a copy of that and post it online, because I don't want to read his entire letter, because it's actually almost 2.5 pages long, covering all the issues and everything. But I will say that Gary Gygax says thank you to all the fans out there for the input, because it's because of the players that the Barbarian exists as it is now.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Cool.
So that was pretty interesting how he came back again, discussed it again, and I don't know, you know, what really all the complaints were, but let me talk to you about some of the differences between the Barbarian in White Dwarf and the Barbarian in Unearthed Arcana. And you all tune in as you see fit. First off, the White Dwarf Barbarian is not a subclass of fighter, vice where the Barbarian in UA is a subclass of fighter.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of weird. So I guess he was a class onto his own. The White Dwarf Barbarian makes saving throws as a cleric, vice those of the UA Barbarian, which makes, you know, saving throws as that of a fighter.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
Which is kind of weird, because you figure, you know, this Barbarian detests magic, but that's the UA variant. Huh. The White Dwarf Barbarian prerequisite scores are lower than those of the Barbarian in the UA. And I will note that the UA variant require higher scores.
Yes.
Hmm.
Now, this is the fun part here, because this is where a lot of conflict comes in. The White Dwarf Barbarian uses a D6 for hit points. Unlike the Barbarian.
Really?
Yes, unlike the Barbarian in the UA, which uses a D10 due to the errata.
It was a D12, wasn't it, at one point?
I thought it was a D12. Yeah,
it was a D12, but that was changed to a D10. That was in the errata, which is covered in number 63 when they covered all that information.
Correct. Okay, you're right. Okay.
Yes.
Looking at that right now. You're right.
Oh, I'm sorry. I take that back now. The Dragon Magazine number 63, we just covered the Big Bad Barbarian before it was released into the UA. But it was Dragon Magazine number 103 that covers the errata for the UA. And that right there tells you it's a D10. Now, White Dwarf Barbarians can catch missiles such as arrows, but not magical missiles or bullets. The UA Barbarian does not.
Right.
And then, of course, the White Dwarf Barbarians are limited to armor. However, the UA Barbarian is not, despite the penalties for using heavier armor. They made that very specific there in White Dwarf. And then the White Dwarf Barbarian is limited to use of weapons, where the UA Barbarian is not. The UA Barbarian, now this is the fun one here, has the ability to hit magical creatures, you know, as they go up in level, whereas the White Dwarf variant does not have that ability. And then last but not least, this is one of the biggest issues. The White Dwarf Barbarian has no real adversity to magic or magical items and the like, unlike the UA Barbarian, who has a phenomenal, he just detests magical items and casters of any kind, pretty much, and so on. So you see a lot of differences in the White Dwarf variant and the UA variant.
Yeah.
I like the White Dwarf one better than the UA one, honestly. It's different. It just comes across better. I don't know.
Yeah, the white dwarf one has a lot more. The focus of the character isn't as narrow, so you have more opportunities to create different types of barbarians. It doesn't have to be the Conan Smash barbarian by having the where they're actually able to use magic, where they're. Saving throws of the cleric. It just, I don't know, for some reason, I'm just getting a vision of more like of a uncivilized monk in some ways with the White Dwarf Barbarian. It just seems like they're like a simple people, but they're still a civilization, whereas the Barbarian in UA is more of a, we go out, we plunder, we pillage, we smash, and that's about all we do.
And get to the chopper!
Yes, get to the chopper. That's why they're pillaging and smashing. They're looking for a chopper in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, well.
That's totally different from what I did there. I don't understand. You know, but I respect the differences. I never understood why they had the whole, you know, aversion to magic users. And I never, ever, ever liked how the barbarian destroying magical items gets experience points for destroying them.
Well, that
is some of the biggest conflicts encountered when the UA first came out. I have to go back to the Conan movie when he met that, you know, that witch in the woods and everything, and she did a little bit of that magical stuff. Yeah, it scared him for a second, but it certainly didn't stop him, you know, from having sex with her. You know, that was, I mean,
that's true.
That's kind of weird. I mean, you detest magic, but you're still going to have sex with a witch. I mean, give me a break.
I wonder if they bit that off of the whole Thunder the Barbarian cartoon thing.
Demon dogs.
How he didn't like magic and everything.
I have no idea. Did Conan come out before Thundar?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought so, too.
Oh, no.
No, Thundar was in the 70s, wasn't it?
No, it was 80, 81, something like that.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe they bit the
first Conan film came out in 82.
And I thought the whole magic thing with hating magic and magic is bad was all Thundar and everything.
Oh, no. Thundar came out. I just remember the last.
What, Matt?
Like 1980 for Thundar.
It was Thundar, yeah. I just remembered the last campaign that we had a barbarian character in. Everybody in the whole group was like, when there was magic items, he's like, I'm going to take one. Everyone goes, no.
And Conan was created in 1932.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah. Conan well predates Thundar.
So Thundar could have been a bite off of Conan, which then they use the barbarian class off of, just mixing the two. That's what I'm
guessing.
It's
kind of weird. But, you know, Nick, you know that's right and everything, and that, I think, is why that there's so many problems with running a barbarian. It's like we talk about these other classes, like, you know, the paladin and all that, is that the above-board gaming, the metagaming, you know, a barbarian is not going to know that a sword is +1 or +2. He's not going to know that a potion is magical. He's not going to know if armor is magical unless someone tells him, hey, guess what, you know, dimwit, that is a magical piece of armor. What are you going to do? Get to the chopper, you know, whatever, you know. I mean,
going to destroy it.
Or maybe the barbarian starts smashing things he thinks is magic when they're not, because he mistakes them for magic.
Exactly.
That is a good point. And you know what? There's a good analogy. That's the same thing with people that play Kinder. And they say they're always curious, and it gets them into so much trouble. And that's exactly what the player does with a barbarian. He's going to get the entire party in trouble. You know, right. If he sees a stick and a big ball of fire coming out of it, or a magic missile, or, you know, a ray of frost or what have you, yeah, I guess he could make sense. 2 + 1 = 5. This is magical. I will destroy it. You know, I can understand that, but, oh, my Lord.
I must crush it.
Yes, no. I now have a vision for a campaign adventure I must run Tomb of Horrors, Kinder Barbarians.
Oh, God. Get to be curious about it and then destroy it.
Get to the chopper now! Get to the chopper! Now!
Oh, you guys are killing me and everything. But, you know, I think the Barbarian is an interesting character class. I do have the issues with it detesting magic. I can understand them distrusting. You know, that's the funny part. They despise magic users, but they have really no problem with, you know, like clerics or shamans, if you might say.
Yeah, right. Which is weird.
So the magic user can lie and just say, I'm a shaman.
Well, when it's time said, I need some healing. Let me see here. Magic missile? Let me try this. You know, whatever the case may be. It didn't work.
Heal the barbarian with a magic missile? I don't think so. Here.
Oh, it might sear the wound, though. It might, you know, cauterize the wound.
Yes. I used the mud because I had a tumor. It's not a tumor. Anyway.
Really, it isn't.
Anyway, enough of making fun of them. Barbarian, how do you guys play it?
We'll just like this, I hear.
Oh, boy. We're gonna get ripped apart for this one now.
Chop his head off there.
And get to the job ball. Let's head into the next segment of game mechanics now.
No, I like the Barbarian. I think he's pretty cool, and I never had a real problem with it, except for that whole, you know, detest magic thing. I prefer the distrust thing. So that's where I'm kind of with it.
Okay.
I like the Barbarian. It has a lot of, the Barbarian class has a lot of amazing abilities that a lot of the other character classes, I think he's unique to them. You know, like detecting the illusion, the leaping and springing, you know, abilities. He has the ability to surprise foes much more easily. And then, you know, he also has a leadership, you know, ability too as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of things with the Barbarian. Very useful. Almost supplements the Ranger to a certain extent, especially when in the wilderness.
Yep.
So then, would I rather have a Barbarian or a Ranger? Well, honestly, I prefer a Ranger over a Barbarian. But, you know, like I said, it all depends on the DM and the campaign and the player who's going to play the Barbarian to the T. If they play by the book, all I can say is good luck, magic users and magic items.
Did they say
potions.
I never read the errata for the UA. Did they say why they dropped the hit points down to D10?
You know what? I don't think the rider really covered too much of that and everything. You know, I'm going to take a look real quick like and everything. I'm looking at the Barbarian right now.
I didn't see anything about the hit dice going down.
Right. It didn't cover too much. I have the wrong UA. I got an older UA where I put all the errata in there and everything. But no, I really honestly cannot answer that now at this time. I apologize.
I was just curious if Gary said, well, this is the reason why and blah, 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 because I'm Gary. But anyway.
Well, I think that he covered that in the article, you know, in Dragon Magazine number 67. I will definitely post that as soon as we post this link for this show on the site and everything. It's very interesting how he covered that. But like I said, in one other article, he plainly says right now it is a very underpowered character. In order for it to be an overpowered character, his prerequisites had to be in the 16, 17, and 18s. So I don't know what the big conflict was as far as that was concerned. But between a D6 and a D12, I mean, honestly, I would think the Barbarian would be great with a D12. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
But that's what they're known for, their hardiness constitution.
Yeah,
look where they come from, you know?
Yeah, it's not like the extra one or two hit points a level or over the course of the Barbarian's existence is really going to make that much of a difference. So, yeah, I have no problem giving them a 12-sided either. Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
I've always played with the 12-sider, so I didn't even know there was errata, so
I never even thought to look for it.
Well, I'll do you all a favor. As soon as we post this on the site, I will make sure that I put it on there and show you.
Groovy. Cool. Okay. Game mechanics, heading up next.
Oh man, what the heck is that?
Stand aside, you fool! I have a spell that will work here!
What do you mean I can't hit with that? Oh right, fine. Show it to me in the book.
Welcome to Game Mechanics.
right. On Game Mechanics in this issue, we're going to be talking about something out of the DMG. Saving throws for items, either magical or non-magical. And let's talk about a little bit how it works. Are there different methods and why use it? And this is in the Dungeon Master's Guide, page 80, and kind of goes over to page 81. So there is the chart for the saving throw matrix for magical and non-magical items. And there's whole different types of items and the attack form. The best analogy I can use for this is, let's say you have Joe the Fighter.
The Great Joe Fighter?
Yes. Let's say Joe the Great Joe Fighter. And he is hit by a fireball. Okay? Exactly. And next to Joe the Fighter, when he was in the room, say there was a sack with some magical items.
Right.
Now, Joe the Fighter, with his, let's say he has like a magical armor on and a sword and everything like that, a magical sword, what have you. His saving throw for his character, once he makes that, that saving throw covers everything on the body of that character. Okay?
Okay.
Now, item saving throw comes into this, that sack that Joe was going to look in and see what all that good gold and stuff was in. Maybe a few magic items that he was just about to plunder. This is where this chart comes into. So I want to make that one distinction here. You don't have to make a saving throw for each individual item on Joe's body if he fails it, if he makes a saving throw. Now, maybe if he fails it, you could maybe do a saving throw if you want to for each individual item. But if he fails it, generally he fails it all, boom. But like this sack, and let's just say it has some gold pieces in it, and it's got some a wand in it, a magic wand, and a couple of magic arrows, okay, to give us a little bit of variety, okay? So now the separate item that was in the blast radius of the fireball, I'm just using fireball as a pretty good example.
It's good.
Is you just look on the chart and you look for the attack form is fireball. And let's say the sack that is cloth, right?
Yes.
And you need to roll a 20 on a 20 sided die for that cloth not to burst into flames. Okay.
Jeez.
That's just one example. And you can look down the list of the different various forms of attacks and the items. Now, let's talk about that magic wand that was in there. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That magic wand, for example, it would, let's say it's like, I don't know, ironically enough, let's say it's a wand of fireballs.
Okay.
Okay. That magic item, when you look under saving throw, item saving throws on page 81, I'm sorry, not there, but under magic items, there's where it says magical items under the saving throw matrix.
Mm-hmm.
It says magical items getting +2 on all rolls plus a +1 for each plus they have above one. Now, that wand of fireballs, it doesn't have a magical plus to it, but all magic items get a +2 to their saving throw if it doesn't have a magical bonus, like a sword +1, you know?
Okay.
A sword +1, like these arrows, maybe they're arrows +1. They get a +1 to the arrows, and then they get an additional +2, okay?
Okay.
So you would take those modifiers into account when you roll on the chart. So let's say it's a... Let's say the wand is made out of bone or ivory.
All right.
So it would adjust the fireball saving throw by 2, so you would only need a 15 or better on a d20 for that magic item to save. But in this case, the magic item gets a +5 against attack forms of its own mode. Because it's a wand of fireballs, okay? So it would even modify it even better. So this is just an example of ways that you can have these various items in this particular case, like with a fireball. Could have been maybe a squirt of acid, maybe come out of like a chest or something when you're checking the treasure chest and the squirts acid everywhere. Maybe every item in that chest has to make a saving throw, an adjustment. It has to make a saving throw. So, yeah, there are various modifiers for the different attacks. Like, also, you wouldn't have to make a saving throw for the gold, too. It'd be metal, soft, or jewelry. You'd have to make a saving throw for that, for the gold. It just turns into slag or something like that. So, there's not a whole lot about other than that. You have the different attack forms that it talks about. Acid, crushing blow, normal blow, disintegration, and so on. It gives brief explanations of each type of attack form and where would you use them. But other than that, this is where you would use these saving throws for magical items is, as I've already said, it's separate from a regular saving throw for a character. And everything on that character's person is included in that person's saving throw. So you don't have to make a separate save for everything. It's just when it's on its own, like if you're falling 50 feet, for example, and you drop whatever is in your hand and it's falling too, that thing, whatever is in your hand, has to make a separate saving throw when you're falling, just to give an example. So how does that make all sense for everybody? It kind of makes sense.
I think it's a game stopper, in my opinion. Just rolling.
It can be. That's why you only use it separately. I very rarely use these myself. That's why when I said a saving throw for a player character or a monster or whatever, you don't have to make a saving throw for every item on that person. I mean, say you had that sack of gold and a few magic items and it got caught in that lightning bolt or whatever, you might have to make a save for magic items. This is also kind of a way of being a real nasty, conniving DM. Yeah. If you really want to have people lose items like I did for a character who had this darn cloak of displacement. I've tried for years trying to destroy it. Nah, I haven't done it yet. So, so what do you guys think, Matt or Will? Have you used the magical item saving throws?
No, I haven't.
Specific occurrences?
No, I really haven't. It's just one of those things that just feels like it would slow the game down way too much if I really apply it correctly. Otherwise, it would be so situational. The players could be like, well, you didn't do it in this case, but why are you doing it now?
Right.
Because
right.
I feel like it. I mean, so it's just, to really use it by the book, it would just slow things down so much. I wouldn't use it.
Well, I guess I'm in the minority then, because I do use the same throw matrix for items and everything. I'm just I have ever since day one, when I got hit by a breath weapon of a dragon, I had to make all my saving throws, which is fine. It adds to the game. Does it slow it down? Yeah, there's going to have to be a pause. There's going to have to be a break. So we have to make saving throws of every item that was exposed to the attack. So then if you have a list there. Oh, yes, very much serious. Everything that is exposed. So let me give you an example here. If I got hit by the breath weapon of a red dragon and I made or failed my saving throw, everything that is exposed to that breath weapon has to make a saving throw. Now, if there's stuff in a backpack, that stuff will not have to make a saving throw because the backpack, has to make the determination. If the backpack fails the saving throw, then I got some problems then, my friend. I did. But that was how it was run back then, and I prefer to use this system. I think it's pretty good.
Well, if you're playing by the book, then that's pretty much what you have to do.
Yeah, you know what? I prefer to do this. At least I have a chance to save in the item. And let me just give you an example on this, because I don't know if you ever went through WG5, which is Morden Kanan's Fantastic Adventure.
I have that one, yes.
Well, if you remember that one room they walk into, I don't know if it was per person or a player was picked, they had to make a saving throw. if they failed their saving throw, they had to take something that was in their hand and slide it in through that slot in order to enter that place. But whatever was entered into that slot was, you know, destroyed automatically. There was no saving throw for it. So you know what? I would rather go ahead and take a chance of making a saving throw. If it fails, that's because my dice rolled terribly instead of giving the option that your item automatically fails its saving throw and it's destroyed permanently.
See, but I can't see how, like, use the breath weapon from a dragon example, how making a saving throw for each and every individual exposed item on your person. I've always played it to where if it's for the player character, they make their saving throw, they make it, you're good. If you don't make it, you take some damage. But I don't make saving throws for each individual item. The only time I do that is if the item is completely separate, like lying around and it's exposed to the attack or something.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, I look at it like this, though. If I'm just going to use the breath weapon again. A red dragon blows his breath weapon on you. You make your saving throw. You're going to take damage. That just means you get out of most of the blast and everything. I can see to where Dean would adjudicate that, you know, you probably won't have to make any saving throws. But if you're engulfed, you fail your saving throw, you're engulfed entirely in this red dragon's breath weapon. And your sword is out. Your armor's out. All your leather items and everything is out. Anything that's in the open has to make a saving throw. I think it's very simple. I wouldn't. Well, you know, I mean, this is it's just one
have
of those things.
Have you not seen some player characters and the list, the stuff that they have?
Okay, now if they want to have
crazy.
Well, if they have 2 pages of items, then you know what? To save time, I'm just gonna make one saving throw. Everything fails. Everything's destroyed. Guess what? Go to the store.
Yeah, and, you know, there you go. Wow.
You know, but the big thing, understand that these are non-magical items. This is mundane gear. I mean, yeah, it would stink for, you know, like maybe a thief because he might lose his, you know, pickpocket tools and all that other stuff and everything. Or, you know, thieving, you know, tools and so on. Okay, that might be a problem. It would stink for a magic user because the spell book disappears, gets incinerated. Uh-oh, now you're in trouble. Yeah. You know, and, you know, the poor cleric, all his candles melt. Oh, well, you know, what are you going to do now?
Yeah. I think this is one way, I think I just said earlier, this is one way of being a kind of a evil conniving DM to the players. Certain things like, oh, darn, you know, you failed your saving throw for your sword because it's like it was exposed to that cone of cold and you hit it against the wall and it shattered. Oh, that's too bad.
Oh, you know.
You know, stuff like that.
You know, the funny thing about it is, though, I don't understand the chart where how it differentiates between magical fire and that of, you know, breath weapons. I really didn't understand the logic. You got magical fire, then you have fireball. I don't understand the difference between the two.
Well, I think for the magical fire, it's talking about other spells besides fireball, like wall of fire, flame strike, and so on. It's not as – maybe those are – they're not as intense or more intense. In fact, the magical fire ones are not nearly as intense as the fireball one. So,
well, I thought that so as well, because when I look at it, if you look at bone ivory, for a fireball, you need a 17 or better to make the saving throw. But under magical fire, you need a 9 or better.
Right.
So that's I'm confused there on how they decided that it dictated these numbers on which is more powerful. So it sounds like the fireball is much more nastier than, you know, the magical fire.
Yeah.
But well, a fireball
let's
is
test it out. Let's see, Bill. Let's see if you get hit by a fireball and then flame strike. Which one's gonna hurt? I don't know.
I think everyone will take the flame strike or a fireball with 33,000 cubic, you know, feet or square feet or whatever it is. Yeah,
that's one for Mythbusters that we have. They have to do for us.
All right, we'll call them up right after the show and find out.
Okay, so I don't know. I think we're pretty good on this one. So
agree to disagree.
Anybody else? No one else has anything to add on to this. Let's move on to our next feature, which is Creature Feature Theater.
That is not dead, which can eternify, and with strange ears, even death may die.
I welcome the unwary to the Creature Feature Theater.
The This week on the Creature Feature Theater, we have the greatest drawn monster ever. Every edition is always the same, never changes its looks. And I love drawing it myself. No, I'm kidding. The Invisible Stalker.
Draw it yourself.
This is one monster I can surely draw. I love its picture. It's always blank in every edition.
Yes.
I think maybe in the later editions they actually did put a picture of what it looks like. Finally. I can't be positive on that, but...
You are correct, because it looked like kind of like a smoky-looking monster with eyeballs.
So they did do it. Okay. I know in second edition they had like a square box outlined, and that was all it was.
That was all it was.
Yeah. So if we flip to the Monster Manual, page 55, this is basically a invisible creature from the astral plane, and is conjured by a magic user, and will do whatever
I thought it was from the elemental plane of air.
Is it?
Yes.
I thought it was.
Yeah, it's from the elemental plane of air.
Oh, air. Why say astral plane? Elemental plane of air. I was reading it really quickly here.
They roam the astral plane and ethereal planes, but they come from the plane of air.
And you really can't see them unless you have detect invisibility or see invisibility. And they do anything what the magic user commands them to do flawlessly and does the task until completed and then will disappear, or until it's killed, it will be disappeared. So it, you have to be careful what you say, because this is another creature that the DM can twist around on you, depending on how, like a wish.
Yeah.
Because there's some examples here of the Invisible Stalker of them saying, keep me safe from harm and threat and whatever. And the Invisible Stalker will come and grab the magic user and bring him to their plane and put him in suspended animation for the rest of their life. Hey, that's keeping them safe from harm and anything else, right? But the creature will do what the magic user, or the caster, I should say, says. And each day that it continues to be in service to the magic user or caster, there's a 1% chance it'll, as they put, pervert what the magic user is doing and try to, like, pretty much turn on them. So each day that continues, which is kind of interesting because it doesn't want to be in service to you, so it's just doing it because you're making it. So I could see this being twisted around very easily.
Oh, yes, yeah. Definitely. Yep.
And this is a thing you do not want to turn on you. Uh-uh.
No, it's the perfect assassin, because there's no way to detect it unless you detect invisibility. I have heard various DMs saying that the Invisible Stalker does leave footprints. I have also heard people say that it does not leave footprints. I guess it depends on the DM. I don't know if they clarified that in later editions that it does leave footprints in the ground. But I do know that there was a big debate a while back on one of the campaigns that we had an Invisible Stalker, and I was saying that there was no foot tracks or footprints, and the people argued with me that they leave these marks in the ground. I don't think they do. What do you guys think about that?
I think as a creature from the elemental plane of air, I don't think they would leave tracks.
No, that's what I said. Don't think they would either.
I'm looking at this thing. I forgot how nasty it was, just looking at the stats. I mean, armor class 3, 8 hit dice.
Yeah.
One attack, but 4 to 16 points of damage on one attack. Ow! You know? Surprise on a 1 through 5 on a D6, 30% magic resistance. Yeah, this is the being from the id. You know, from Forbidden Planet. It's like the being from the id. That's how I kind of pictured this thing.
Yeah, but remember now, that creature there left footprints. Big ones, too.
Yeah, but this one doesn't. So it's still the being. I think it's like that creature from the id. It's just like, you know, I just had this, you know, this picture of this creature, how it would be like, and you hear the thumping and everything when it comes up on you.
I agree, though. I don't think it leaves footprints. I don't think it actually even touches the deck.
Yeah. And in later editions, let's see here as I pull out my book, it is basically just a rolling cloud of vapor when you cast True Seeing. So it would not leave footprints, because it's just more of a amorphous mass as opposed to actually a humanoid shape. So no footprints.
I mean, it's called an invisible stalker. Invisible.
I remember one reference from a game with the great Joe DM, when I had used an invisible stalker, and my invisible stalker was killed. That I didn't know how he was killed, and when I went to investigate, Joe had made a mention that there was an indent in the ground But he never said what was there. He just said you seem to see what seems like the shape of a body on the ground.
That's one massive like creature.
I was like, I guess
that's sort of like the invisible swordsman from Three Amigos.
Yes. I was just like, I guess that's my
invisible swordsman.
Yeah, I guess that's my guy.
Well, I wouldn't have ruled that if you have slain the invisible stalker. I would suspect that being that it is from the elemental plane of air, that it would disperse. Its body would disperse.
According to the rules, it does. Yeah.
I got a question on this. When you summon this creature, is it just from a standard monster summoning spell, or is there a separate? I don't remember summon invisible stalker as a spell.
There is. I think it's its own spell.
I don't remember there ever being a summon invisible stalker spell.
It's like invisible servant.
Well, whatever the case it may be, it's still a very deadly spell.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Summoning an 8 hit dice creature that's practically
unseen servant is what I was thinking.
Is it unseen servant?
But that doesn't summon an invisible stalker. But that's what I was thinking of. The unseen servant.
I'm just curious how that creature is summoned. So
maybe it's something that just was never. I don't remember ever seeing a spell for it either. Maybe it's a ritual of some type that never got printed in one of the books. Will, you remember anything about it?
Well, I do know that in the first edition, DMG, I think somewhere in the back of the book, there is a complete table of monsters that can be summoned. But, I can't recall right now at this time if Invisible Stalker is one of them. Let me take a look here for you. And as a matter of fact, yes, I do. I do see it right now. Monster summoning spell number 7. Dice score, Invisible Stalker is a 53-55. Now, this is a random thing for this, right. But I wouldn't be surprised that if it isn't specific, that the DM would adjudicate that there's a certain ritual to summon specifically an Invisible Stalker using the Monster Summoning 7 spell.
And that is the highest one of Monster Summoning, too. So you got to be pretty high level as a magic user. You got to be like 13th or 14th level even to summon those creatures.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's the Invisible Stalker in a nutshell that you can't see.
No.
I will tell you this, though. If you have a player that's involved with trying to summon these things, I think one of the best magical items to use to keep track of this thing is that Dust of Appearance. Because we do know it's invisible, that lasts much more longer than that Detect Invisibility spell. So remember, if you were dealing with these things, Dust of Appearance is one of the best magical items to deal with that.
I still remember too when this creature first showed up in Joe's campaign, because I had that spell, I summoned it, and he's like, "You summon, okay?" I go, "Well, what did I summon?" He's like, "You don't see anything." I'm like, So I remember saying, my character steps forward and he says, "Whoever's there, make your presence known." He's like, "You feel a smack in the back of your head." I'm like, "Oh, great!" An invisible stalker showed up. So that was that.
But I will tell you this, though. When I think about it, the Invisible Stalker, as it moves around, it may not leave footprints, but I would suspect that it would disturb, like, dust, maybe a light coat of sand. Like, if an Invisible Stalker was, running across the desert or what have you, or floating or whatever it does, I'm certain it would disturb those areas, and you could pretty figure out where it's at.
Yeah, it would make its presence known in certain ways when it's moving. So, the disturb, with dust, dirt, leaves, what have you.
Sure. Cool. Alright, so tell us how you use him. Invisible Stalker, tell us your stories about how you met the Invisible Stalker. Those are always interesting stories. RFI staff gmail.
What about the Invisible Christopher Walken?
No, we don't want an invisible. We kill it instantly.
Fine, go away. See ya.
And in the Invisible Chopper. Anyway.
Oh my lord.
Dragon Sword coming up next.
As the secret portal yields to your efforts, you stand amazed at a vision from the most fevered dreams of avarice. Before you lies the Dragon's Horde.
Okay, today on Dragon Horde, we're going to cover a very unused item as far as I'm concerned, the Trident of Warning. Honestly, I haven't met too many players in my entire life of gaming that ever used a trident as a weapon of choice for their primary character.
Trident of Warning, isn't that like a flavor of gum or something?
It's trident of cinnamon.
Yes.
Yeah, it's something. I have no idea. But basically, a weapon of this type enables its wielder to determine the location, depth, species, and number of hostile and or hungry marine predators within 240 feet. And you know, like I said, I mean, the purpose of this item is to do just that, but how many times have players actually played in a underwater locale? Honestly.
Does Waterworld count? Oh, but that was a movie.
And not a very good one.
Hey, anyway. Kevin Costner. Anyway, we'll get to that another time.
But basically, in order to use it, the welder of the trident must be grasped the weapon and pointed in order for the weapon to gain such information, and it requires one round to scan a 240 radius hemisphere. There are 19 to 24 charges in a trident of this type, each charge sufficient to last for two rounds of scanning. That's not really long at all, really, to be honest. And the weapon otherwise is considered a plus two magical weapon. So that covers the Trident of Warning.
I could see using this in a campaign, but making the trident be able to use on the land, maybe.
Well, sure, you can use tridents on land. I mean, you don't have to be within the water, I think, to use the special abilities. This has to be, 240 feet, right?
Right, and it has to be marine predators, though.
Yes, it says hungry marine predators.
So if you were going to cross that lake.
Right. Or if you were being chased by a land shark.
Right. Or if the creature from the Black Lagoon was after you.
Right.
Or a school of piranhas.
Right. Or if where shark was after you.
Where shark? Yes. Yes.
Kuotoa.
Kuotoa,
yeah.
Kuotoa. Vodunoi.
I think.
Yeah, definitely those.
I think this item, I could be wrong. But the U series of modules, Sinister Secret of Salt Marsh, I know the last module is called The Final Enemy because it's got Sahuagin in it, and we played through that. I think there is a Trident of Warning that can be found within one of those three.
I believe you're correct too, as well. I think there is too.
I'm almost certain of it. And, but that would be useful in that respect within one of those adventures. So, I mean, other than that, yeah, how often do you, go on aquatic adventures? If you can have its uses. If you're going to cross a particular lake or river and you want to make sure that there's no aquatic predators and around when you're going to cross, this is where it would come in handy,
Sure.
Right, and it's still a plus two magical weapon, so that's still nothing to sneeze at. So, I mean, it still has its uses.
Plus two trident, heck. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, how long are those things? How long are tridents anyway? Does anyone by chance know?
I believe it's about 6 feet.
6 feet,
yeah.
Wow, 6 feet. That makes it kind of difficult if you're in a closed dungeon. Yeah, I see how that works. That's cool.
Whenever Neptune actually held it or had it next to him.
Here's the thing. The nice thing about a trident, small to medium-sized creature damage is 2 to 7. Large creatures, 3 to 12.
Wow.
So, there you go.
The trident depends. The size of the trident depends on what you're looking at for a source. When Neptune actually held the trident, it was bigger than him. If you look at the comic books in Aquaman, it was smaller than him.
Yeah.
That's a pitchfork then.
Yeah, it all depends on what source you're looking at.
No, that was just interesting. Like I said, I've seen it, I just can't recall a moment. And, when you bring up the Salt Marsh series, I believe there is a Trident of Warning that could be found somewhere in the lair of those underwater monsters. But really, I mean, honestly, would I have a character use it? Nah, never. Probably not. I'd give it to the cleric or someone else who can use it.
Ways to use it? I'd probably say use it as campfire dust. I don't know.
Oh. I like the idea in case you have to traverse a particular large body of water. Yeah. You want to detect in those...
But you're going to be that guy to lug it around until we find some water?
It's still a plus two trident. It still does pretty good damage when it hits.
Yeah, if you can figure out a way to use it.
What?
If you can figure out a way to use it.
Yeah, you stab people with it. That's how you use it.
You take it to the local docks and sell it to a sea captain who could use it.
Yarr. You can use it above water. There's no reason why you can't.
I would be stabbing me fish with this trident.
Right. I mean, hey, I would use it. Fine. I guess I'm in the minority on this one.
That's right. So next character we make, Nick, you're going to have a trident of warning.
Fine. Good.
Yeah.
So what do you consider a hemisphere? Is that like one half?
Yeah.
A 180-degree arc in front of you.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I guess you can use it on land. That would make sense then.
Yeah. Yeah. Like does, I said, when you're crossing that river, you know, you want to make sure that there's no, I don't know, giant catfish are going to eat you. I don't know.
But I will note another thing that, yes, it is stated that this is a +2 weapon. In the next edition of D&D, it's not even considered a +2 weapon. It's just a trident of warning.
They downgraded it.
and that's why first edition's better.
And that's why that's what it says in Encyclopedia Magica anyway, so.
All comments are sent to DM Nick at rfipodcast.com.
Am I making controversy again?
Yes.
Good.
I'm sure Full On Gamer will send another email or voicemail ranting you out again, Nick.
Oh, God.
Hey, you know what I just thought of? You could use the Trident of Warning to roast marshmallows.
You know.
Yeah.
I would say you can pick it up. You can use it to pick up a large amount of spaghetti.
I like this item.
And with that pinch, you could use it as a farming implement.
Yes. Yes, you could.
Roast hot dogs.
You could use it to chase after the ogre with the pitchforks and the torches.
That's right.
Roast hot dogs, Nick.
Yeah, I think we beat this one to death.
Yes. With that said, I guess that'll end the show this week.
Aw. Gee.
And like we always...
Fine. Next character, I'm going to make a proficient in trident. Just to be different. Just to be different.
Trident gum?
Trident warning comes up. Ha ha to all the rest of you guys.
Ha ha, I got my wintergreen ready to go.
Yes.
No. Yeah. I'm pulling out my spear of mint.
Ooh.
Then the invisible Christopher Walken comes by, stabbed by the trident. Terrible.
You know what? I'm going to get my invisible Charles Grodin to come after your invisible Christopher Walken, all right?
Oh, my Lord.
Keep it original, keep it old school, and remember, you rule the game, not the other way around. Good night.
Roll for initiative.